My name is Tyler Fornes, and I am one of the co-hosts of the Good, the Bad, and the Hungy AEW podcast here on the Voice of Wrestling Podcasting Network. We take a broad scope approach to the world of All Elite Wrestling and the entire universe of Tony Khan. We talk about the big matches, the big stars, the promos, the storylines, and we also look at it from a big picture perspective. How are things going to change over the course of the next 10 years with AEW still in the picture? How are companies like WWE going to adapt and adjust to AEW? Are they going to be a similar way like they did with WCW in the late 1990s? Will there be a counterpunch? We talk about all of that and more on The Good, The Bad, and The Hungy every week on the Voices of Wrestling Network.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
What everyone, it's this week's episode of The Good, The Bad, and The Hungy. I'm your host, Fred. Tyler is out today because of football. About that time of the year where he, and definitely only he in the wrestling sphere, gets distracted by the professional football. And just how awful J.J. McCarthy is. Look, I can't blame J.J. for being bad, because if I was drafted to the Minnesota Vikings, I'd also be bad, because in the 21st century, there's been two paths for a quarterback drafted by the Minnesota Vikings, which is either being an absolute bust or having your leg explode and possibly coming closer to death than you should. So between those two options, I'll take the busthood. I'll cash the checks and be a disappointment and not have my body implode. That's just, that's me. Maybe that's cowardice. I don't know. I prefer my legs not being broken in five pieces on a practice field. God bless the Vikings. They're always going to be disappointing. Okay. All right. So let's talk about Full Gear. There wasn't very much news, as far as, backstage stuff that I saw coming out of Full Gear. Didn't really see any, injury updates or anything. Now, we did have Jamie Hayter get her mouth get messed up when, was that Megan Bain that threw a chair into her face during the Blood and Guts match? I think it was Megan Bain. I hope I'm right on that. If I'm wrong, well, you guys are used to me being incompetent, so that's fine. But the nasty spot, so she's apparently going to wrestle in a few weeks, ? If I was smart, I would have kept that tab open. I got bad news for you. I didn't. Definitely not vamping until I do December 5th. So yeah, okay, so in a couple weeks, yeah. So I didn't think it'd be a long-term injury, but good that she's doing well enough to come back that soon. Poor Jamie Hayter, we really need her to stay healthy, but that's another topic for another day. So Full Gear. I think this show definitely delivered in the ring. Once we got past the pre-show, I think once we got into the meat of it, in general, I thought it was a really good show. I did like basically all matches on the main card, except for the most, or the women's tag, I should say. That one was, I think it's fair to say that wasn't a success. Wasn't the worst thing I've ever seen. There's gradations here. But yeah, let's get into it. So pre-show was pretty standard. We opened with the Tony Khan's really into this purse matches for purses with five, six, seven figures in them. But the tag team four-way that opened it, Austin Gunn and Juice Robinson defeating Max Caster and Anthony Bowens, Big Bill and Brian Keith, and the Outrunners. This was okay. I mean, look, it wasn't bad. It was perfectly acceptable. I went 2.5 stars on it. Thought that the work on it was pretty good. And this was basically here, I think, just to give Austin Gunn and Juice Robinson a win. They definitely teased that they were the last team, I think, to beat FTR. So pretty clear that with this win, they're going to be in a program with them, which FTR should win, I would assume. But we'll get to that. Getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. I thought this was perfectly fine. I think the former Acclaimed, I don't know if once you're Acclaimed, you're always Acclaimed. That's a good question. I think they probably came off the best of all the people in here. I mean, Juice looked pretty good, I thought. In general, everyone else was decent. Less Brian Keith and Big Bill than I thought, but they've been kind of, they're like a phantom limb right now with Jericho out. They're possibly gone. We won't know about that till we know, I guess. This is fine. Yeah, I don't have much more to add here. Next match on the pre-show was Boom and Doom, Big Boom AJ and QT Marshall, getting the win over Rocky Romero and Trip Beretta. This was also just fine. You know, I joke about Big Boom AJ and how he just kind of like shows up. And I don't feel like they really accomplished too much with the matches. And there is a place just for like the baby face, you know, just like the lovable guest, I guess, who comes out, gets a win against the shit heels. And like, that's the extent of the usage of them. I don't know that you can ever really use AJ to, like, elevate anyone. I don't think he's got that kind of juice. I think that he's perfectly fine as this, like, basically he's a converted weekend warrior kind of level guy. And he's, like, perfectly competent. But I just always kind of laugh when people are like, oh, this is what wrestling should be. I mean, it's like a 1991 middle of WCW Saturday Night match. There's nothing wrong with it, but like, you know, in 2025, he sticks out. Trent and Rocky are shockingly very good. Not exactly news there. Don Callis had an absolutely ridiculous line that I wish I could remember about the Rizzler at some point. He referred to him as like being from the wayward home for... Oh, I'm messing it up, and it's going to kill me. I'm looking if I can find it on Blue Sky real quick. It's Don Callis is delightful. Now, I think that they are really heavily leaning on Don Callis, like, probably to the... Like, you get a little overexposed. Okay, here it is. I'm sorry. It looks like he's on a day pass from the home for Incorrigible Boys. Fantastic. One of Don's best lines. Just good stuff. Yeah, this is fine. Eddie Kingston and Hook basically squashed the Workhorsemen. That was 2 minutes. I'm not going to say anything about that match. It was there. It was fine. Whatever. Barely existed. And then we get to El Sky Team. Of course, Místico, Máscara Dorada, and Neon with the CML World Trios Championship, which they successfully defended against the Don Callis family of Okada, Takeshita, and Hechicero. What's more, the Don Callis family. They did the gimmick where they split it over the pre-show and the start of the pay-per-view. I saw someone complaining about that. I think that it's a little early to complain about the regularity of this appearing. It's fine to do it 2 pay-per-views in a row. I do think they should take a break from it. Like, just, you got to keep it a little fresh. You can't be doing it month after month. That does get a little staid. But I, you know, the part of the story of this match was that Okada showed up late, and Takeshita, of course, was disgusted with him while Hechicero was just like, oh man, I want these belts. This sucks. But they took out Místico early for him to make the classic baby face comeback, return from an injury mid-match. Místico is such, just one of the best baby faces of all time, let's be honest. Should have been the easiest thing in the world to nail with WWE, and they did it. Still truly, truly amazing. I thought this was pretty good. Like, it was a 3.5-star match, and I think it accomplished, you know, You got the Lucha guests on, and they look good, and they had a nice little match, and you advanced the story between Takeshita and Fletcher, which they've been building, and I think building pretty nicely. I think that, I do think that there's room for discussion of, like, the quality of AEW's booking this year, because certain things have really been, it's been a very sleepy company, and I think that's a problem. Like, you don't want to go, like, there's a spectrum, right? And there's the spectrum where nothing happens of note, you know, very little happens that feels like it changes the projection, you know, the kayfabe projection of the company. And then there's the other end where you're doing so much shit that, like, no one can keep up. And obviously there's a nice happy medium in between. I feel like AEW has been way too far on the taking it slow kind of thing. Now, we got some stuff happening tonight that I think is, I think it's good. It definitely at least feels like something is occurring, and I feel like that's going to be a big part of the discussion after the main event. And I guess I'm just going to follow card order. I would have planned this out if I was any good at this, but so I like this match well enough. 3.5 stars, nice little showing. Mascara Dorada looked so much better than he did in that Okada singles match that, like, just really crapped the bed. Yeah, you know, you get the continuation of the Okada Takeshita story, which is finally going to blow up in the C2. You can see this coming from a mile away, that something's going to happen. Either they face in the finals, or one eliminates the other, or Okada screws over Takeshita, or maybe even Takeshita screws over Okada in the "I'm acting like a heel, but I'm a babyface, so it's okay" special. Yeah, I think it'll be a great payoff. Next match was Pac versus Darby. Pac versus Darby? Pac. Payuk versus Darby in a very good singles match. I thought this was when the great match streak that almost went throughout the entire show, like, began. I thought this was a really good, just a great, well-worked match, 4.25 stars. Darby remains one of the most unique talents in the company and in the world. I do think... So Pac got the win after interference by the Death Riders, and I'm of two minds here. One, it feels really weird to beat Darby here after he just, you know, beat John Moxley in the big blow-off, and, you know, it's like that was a big thing for Darby. That was kind of the big exclamation point at the end of their story. But obviously the counterpoint is that this win by Pac helps, it really does help advance the Death Rider storyline that they're slow burning, and I think is probably the best thing going in AEW right now as far as, like, the creative aspects of it, is this dissolution of the Death Riders, where you're going to get basically John Moxley. You could see the writing on the wall, and it's going to come in the next few months. And at this point, I think varying from this plan would just kind of be varying for its own sake. But, you know, the idea is that Mox is the weak link of the Death Riders. You know, he's the leader, he talks all this shit, but he's the one tapping out and losing matches, and he lost Blood and Guts, and he lost the big match with Darby, and he lost the world title to Paige. And that's the story, is he's losing, and he's... You know, there's a nice little moment after the, I think, no, wait, it was the Moxley match. Sorry, but a nice little moment where, like, the Death Rider is leaving after Moxley gets his cheap shots in, and Daniel Garcia looks at Claudio. And Claudio, like, that is a meaningful look. And it's one of the best recent examples of, like, well done, subtle character work, I think, in wrestling. So I like this a lot. I'm going to put it over here a little early on the review. But, you know, Claudio just, like, nods, after a moment, nods towards John Moxley for Daniel Garcia to follow. And that definitely, to me, came off as, like, are we going to let this keep going? Like, an unasked question from Daniel Garcia of, like, are we happy with this? You guys bring me in and we're, you know, doing this kind of stuff. And I like that. I liked, that felt like a nice little subtle touch. And they're building this whole storyline well. You know, and Darby, you can heat back up, I think, pretty easily, because he's, you know, he's already over. He's a star. He's super unique. And, you know, you just give him a win and let him do some crazy stuff, and he'll be fine. I figure. But all the same, it did feel weird that, like, the follow-up to him, you know, beating Jon Moxley in that match with Sting's return and all that is that Darby basically gets murder killed in Blood and Guts, and then he loses here. But again, I think that if you know you give him enough wins over the like the next 3 or 4 months, he can be heated up for whatever you want to do with him. Next came what I thought was easily the weakest match on the main card, and again, not like a disaster or anything, but I thought this was just fine with some sloppy work. The Timeless Love Bombs of Toni Storm and Mina Shirakawa beat Willow Nightingale and Harley Cameron, the Sisters of Sin, Julie Hart and Sky Blue, and Megan Bain and Marina Shafir in a four-way, with the winner getting to choose a stipulation for their upcoming match in the, I think on Dynamite, for the tournament, for to crown the first AEW Women's World Tag Team Championship, or champions, I should say. I thought this was all right. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and tell you it was the worst thing I've ever seen. I don't think it was nearly bad, really. It did have some ugly moments, but I think this is just kind of a hard match to pull off well, because you know, I think I've, at points I've thought Mina Shirakawa is all right to like maybe a little good, but she's firmly in that Maki Ito range for me, where like I've seen her be good in her in certain circumstances, but I also have seen her really crap the bed, and I think this is two straight showings by Mina with Blood and Guts. Then this match that I thought were really underwhelming. So that got, you know, but you add in, I think that Julia Hart and Sky Blue are not good at the in-ring aspect of things. I really struggle with how to evaluate them in general, just because I think the whole, like, I'm not a big fan of, like, ooh, we spooky kind of gimmicks. It's not my thing, really. I think they do it about as well as they can, but it kind of comes off very WWE declined, you know, like ideas turned down for the Wyatt family kind of stuff. And I wasn't that big into the Wyatt family when it was a thing. So, but yeah, I mean, Megan Bain's green, or I think is the term I'd use for, she's, you know, has her strengths and has her weaknesses. Marina Shafir is good in this pretty narrow way. And I mean, I'm glad they figured out a way to use her, but in a, she should be working like exclusively 6 or 7 minute matches. And I know this is an 8-person tag team thing, so she can be hit pretty well. And I think was used relatively well within this match structure. And then adding, but like, you know, I think that she is not, is flawed. And then finally, Harley Cameron is very charismatic, and that's what I'll say. God bless her, she tries. And I, you know, I don't know if she's really improving yet, but like, she's just so stupidly early in her career. How old is she? It's not listed, but she's only been doing this for like 2 years or whatever. 3, I guess, but like, it's truly astonishing just how new she is, I guess. It's really hard to, you know, because you're on TV and that's really a hard combo to have, especially if you're not like some kind of preternatural rookie. I like I said, all right match. I'm okay with the booking. I don't think this women's tag tournament has been great. I don't think it's been a disaster or anything, but I don't think it's been any great shakes, really. But I'll tell you what is great shakes is this FTR Brutita match. I loved this, and it was probably my second favorite match of the night. I thought this was just really well worked, a fantastic example of like why FTR in 2025 is having a great year, and if it wasn't for the existence of Sky Team, who have a genuine drawing argument, would be Tag Team of the Year. But I think they're a pretty good number two pick. if you're voting in the Observer Awards and you're voting for Tag Team of the Year and you don't vote for Sky Team, you need to rethink that. There's basically been, I feel like it's fair to say, maybe I'm forgetting someone, but there's basically been one tag team this year that's drawn, and it's them. Plus, they have very good main events on CMLL, like, practically every week, it feels like. So, they should be an easy pick. FDR's got a great working case, and, like, you know, they're doing maybe the best character work of their career, and while I think I'd have to go with the Briscoes year over this one, just in terms of in-ring, their in-ring this year has been very, very good. They're probably, let me double check here. I've got them in my top 30 right now for the FS750, with maybe a match or two to watch that I haven't yet. They should be, I mean, they're having a great year, and they're a wonderful act, and they've really hit, they're hitting on all cylinders as far as a heel act. And I think that, you know, I guess I'll do my conversation here. You know, if you want to evaluate, like, the pluses and minuses of AEW booking, I think that it'd be really foolish to say that it's a failure this year. I also think it'd be very foolish to say it's, you know, just successes across the board. I think it's been kind of a middle-of-the-road kind of year with AEW, and, you know, I think it's been kind of sleepy, and that's a problem. I would say that I think with FTR, part of the problem is that we had a lot of great work from them, but it felt like a lot of it was kind of inconsequential, and in a way, they were just kind of spinning wheels away from the title scene, you know, especially while it was with the Hurt Syndicate. But, you know, FTR had, I like the Priest and Billington, you know, mini feud. They've had, you know, the Kyle O'Reilly, Roderick Strong series this year was good. Even had a little bit of them as faces. You know, prior to that turn, I thought they did a good turn on Daniel Garcia, which didn't really go far. Yeah, I mean, I think they've done really well. And, you know, I think even, look, I wasn't huge into the Copeland-Christian match. I thought it was fine. That was good. Like 3.5, 3.75 good. But I think that, you know, they really helped make sure that match held together while it kind of made dalliances with being too twee, I think is a good way to describe Copeland's, especially, I assume, it feels like to me it's Copeland, but, you know, Copeland's worst instincts are most WWE-coded instincts, and I think they grounded it by just being really good kind of old school heels. I think the Death Riders has been a success. I think the women's division in general has been a success. I think that, you know, you get, I think they've done a great job of elevating Chris Statlander. Even though I think she has weaknesses on the mic. The pre-tape she did on Dynamite was good. The commentary work she did was not good. I think they've really used Mercedes Moné to the maximum of her abilities. And I think Toni Storm's been used really well, too. I think the biggest problem with AEW booking has been, you know, like, it's just very, like, slow motion. Like, I think that an ideal wrestling promotion should have lots of hooks for stuff going forward that get you intrigued. And I feel like there should be, not every week by any stretch, but, like, you should periodically have something big happen that feels like it could potentially change what's going on in your promotion. Because the alternative is that you don't have things happen that feel like they rock your little kayfabe world. And so you get kind of just like, yeah, well, you know, the Death Riders are here and they're being mean, and oh, they lost to Adam Page. His immediate follow-up is like, oh, one day you'll be good, Kyle Fletcher. Like, that didn't feel good. I don't think the Hangman Page booking once he won the title was a success. I think that was one of the weak points of the year's booking. I think the Young Bucks booking has been not great. I think that kind of a chunk of it can probably be attributed to maybe the worst aspects of the Young Bucks creative, as the, like, it just feels a little too none of this shit matters kind of problem. You know, I think that they kind of have sometimes, especially in AEW. Like, just a little too irony-filled, I guess. And I think that's frustrating with them, but they're still very good workers. I feel like they're really trying to rehab Jack Perry and Luchasaurus. I don't know if I would have, but I get it, because Jack Perry... Look, I hated his heel run. It really hurt him in my eyes. I think his return has been pretty good work so far in the ring. I can't really say I've been, like, engaged with his character stuff. But maybe that'll just always be a shortcoming with him. Maybe he's just going to be, like, a mid-card level guy that has pretty good matches and is always, like, mentioned on commentary as the son of Matthew Perry. I don't know. Maybe he'll find his path one day. I think there's still, like, a glimmer of him being able to be a star. But I think that he pushed himself away from it pretty hard with, like, that really dreary heel run. And I think Kenny Omega between... the thing with Kenny Omega and his health is that I feel like every interview he does where he talks about how hurt he is halfway kayfabe, but halfway out. And that's kind of a hard balance to read when you're out on the outside looking in. Just like, how serious is it? The whole, like, oh, I might just retire. I'm selling, you know, a tweaked leg. Am I, you know, is he, like, genuinely hurt? How concerning should this be? I just don't know. So, yeah, like, that's the thing with Kenny. But when he wrestles, he has good performances. Like, and I think it's just at this point we have to accept that, you know, Kenny Omega is not going to be 7-star Kenny Omega. Like, those days are long gone for both him and Okada. They're able to have great matches, but they aren't able to have, like, wrestling redefining matches, you know. Maybe they could again if, you know, one of the two of them really wanted to, but I think there's plenty of reasons going on right now that's not something I put my money on. So, yeah, like, you know, I think that his usage is a little weird. He never seems able to cut a genuine promo. It's always this kind, like, he's a little bit of a goofball, and I think you can make that work for him. But I think a big problem with wrestling today, this is just slowly segueing into just let's talk about the wrestling business at large, is that he, or wrestling in general, is just a little too irony-filled. There's just too much of, like, I gotta wink at the camera because I need people to know that I'm not taking this too seriously. And the problem with that is, you know, if the performers are either not taking it seriously or giving you the okay to not take it seriously, then why does any of this matter? Why does this exist? And that's always the thing. Like the whole, God bless RJ City. I love him. I've really enjoyed the conversation we had with him. I'd love to have him on again. But I remember back when we interviewed him, he dropped a line that, like, oh, wrestling is actually just, it's like the Muppet Show. It's a show about a variety show. And the flaw with that, I think, is that wrestling should show a variety of talent. I think that in the U.S., as a TV product, that it's not really viable to have, like, just, you know, guys go out and grapple. Like, I think that's pretty clear. But I also think that we need to have stakes in it and have reasons to be invested, but not all of it has to be, like, built in the most WWE way possible. You know, the my guest at this time kind of stuff, like just all the different things that are so extremely WWE coded and that AEW should be avoiding. So, that's just my mid-show rant, I guess, about all of that. You know, just various thoughts I have on the state of the company and the industry. And it's, you know, I think FTR is a good example of, like, avoiding those flaws. And I think that, you know, the success of, like, an act like them and various others in the company that have been built well, means that AEW is not, like, the worst promotion on the planet or anything. And it definitely means that, like, Tony Khan is not a bad booker by any stretch. But I think that it's definitely, it is fair to point out weaknesses. Like with Brodito, I think they did a really good job putting this team together and building them up. But I also think at times they kind of undermined it a little bit, that they're like these fighting champions, but they start doing the Macarena in the ring. And that just feels very like Young Bucks coded. And I don't know, maybe this is just me being crusty, just being a grump. I don't know. Maybe I am. And maybe I'm just being too much of a group, but I just kind of think like that kind of stuff, maybe, I don't know. Does it undercut the act? I'm not sure. I kind of lean towards yes, but it certainly depends on the situation. You know, you can do fun stuff, but you can also do it like at the right time and not in the middle of like a serious feud, I guess. Like, I guess that a better example of this would be like if you know, blood and guts involved, you know, you have the Death Riders menacing, you know, the babyface team, and part of the responding babyfaces are, you know, the Outrunners, and they come out and do their whole Dalton, you son of a bitch thing and all that, you know, all the stuff that makes them a fun little goofy undercard act. But like, if you're trying to position them as a proper threat to the Death Riders, you know, I wouldn't get rid of it completely, but I think it'd be foolish to like lean on that. I hope that makes sense. I'm just kind of rambling at this point. I feel like, sorry to the show review. Yeah, so I love this match. I thought it was just really well worked. I love the FTR style. I love their work and their shtick, and Stokely with them is great and great stuff. It taking this long for Stokely to have found a role that sticks in this company is kind of appalling. Like, I just really don't understand that. But anyways, yeah, so next we have the Casino Gauntlet match. I didn't think this was, like, the best one of this genre or this match type ever. And, look, it's really weird that we're doing another championship belt. That we're introducing the national championship, like, in the same year that we're, you know, condensing the mid-card belts. It seems like we're just kind of undoing some of that stuff. But I thought this was fun. I like this. Ricochet is a fantastic little twerp. He, of course, won the match and won the championship, hitting Kevin Knight. I thought this was well worked, a lot of fun, and just fun. I thought this was like a 4-star match. Just good stuff, well worked, and it's kind of a blast. So good stuff here. I will always enjoy Matt Menard, like, just hating Daniel Garcia. This should be, like, the example Joe Lanz always brings up with the Tito Santana, Rick Martel thing, that Matt Menard will never forgive Daniel Garcia for what he did, and it always pops up. I would love for Mark Davis to get himself a little more shine, just somehow. You know, I know he's had some health issues, and obviously that's going to be a problem, but, like, he's just a really great hoss. And there's just a lot of great, a lot of really strong talent in here. You know, with Roddy and Claudio and Orange Cassidy and, you know, Jetspeed and, you know, Wheeler Yuta and Daniel Garcia, I think are very good. You know, just a lot of talent in here. So it was fun. Then next up we had No Holds Barred, Jon Moxley versus Kyle O'Reilly. And this was a blast. I went 4.5 stars on this. I thought they worked really hard, worked a great match, told a great story of Moxley just not being able to back up his talk. He's He's just so skilled. And Kyle O'Reilly, like, I don't know what's going to happen to Kyle O'Reilly once this Death Rider storyline finishes. You could tell me that he just goes back to, like, making goofy faces and in the background of conglomeration segments. So... Yeah, it's just, I thought this was worked fantastically. Brian Danielson is such a good commentator, but he was just fantastic. Just great on this match in particular, putting over the whole storyline, getting over that Moxley's a bit of a paper tiger and helping get that storyline over, talking about how, you know, he promises he's, you know, such a badass, but he starts losing to Kyle O'Reilly, so he breaks out a fork. And, you know, Danielson puts over that it was handed to him by Marina Shafir, and that shows that Marina didn't have confidence in Moxley in this match. Yeah, so, but I love this match. I thought it was a blast. Just great violence. Next match was the TNT title. Mark Briscoe against Kyle Fletcher. No DQ. If Briscoe lost, he would have been forced to join the Callis family, which I think would have been a bunch of really kind of dopey segments that didn't really accomplish anything. So fortunately, we didn't do that. We got Briscoe winning after a hell of a match. Yeah, I think there's a good argument to be had here that there's too much plunder on this show. It did get a little kind of heavy on that, but... That, you know, the spots they did were absolutely insane. And I think it'd be really wrong-headed to not give them credit for that. But I also think it'd be wrong-headed to not talk about, hey, about how, hey, maybe AEW leaned too hard on the plunder on this show. But great stuff here. I mean, Kyle Fletcher's a superstar. It's going to be a little soon for him to be, you know, outright losing up, considering that, you know, that the world title just went back to heels. But I would not be terribly shocked if in the next 12 to 18 months he is world champion. Maybe 24 months, maybe it'll take that long, but I think it is coming. Mark Briscoe has, I've long said that I think he's been underused within AEW. I think he's, you know, been featured, but he never has been pushed as like a top, as a high level star. And I think that, you know, maybe this is resolving that. Maybe this is kind of ducking that issue. I think that he's always had a strong connection with the fans. He's always been over, and he's always a fantastic worker. So I think he definitely needs to be featured heavily. And, you know, this is a great example of it. Both these guys are so fantastic. It's a great match. Fantastic work through it. And... what more can I say? Like, I love this match. Next match was for $1 million. Josh Alexander and the Young Bucks against Jurassic Express and Kenny Omega. I thought this was totally solid. Like, a great, like, a low-level great match. I think I went 4.25 on this. Yeah, I did. Just good stuff. And I don't know, like, I think it took too long to get here, but and like just too many segments with the Young Bucks making their we're conflicted, so we're making kind of mopey faces gimmick, you know. But you know, this was a solid payoff. I'm not exactly gonna, like, I don't think anyone's gonna write a book of like the greatest turns in wrestling history, put this in there, but I thought it was effective enough. Crowds clearly wanted them to be faces, I think, and this got them there. And I guess it feels safe to assume that they're going to continue to feud with the Callis family moving forward. Work on this was very good. I thought Jack Perry came off pretty damn well. And this is as someone who, like, his match with Brian Danielson during his possibly, I will never believe that Brian Danielson's retired until, like, he's in a body cast or something. It's just, you know, I will always hold out hope that we'll get more matches from him just because purely selfishly. But, you know, Perry had that awful match with him a year ago in the midst. I think it was a year. Was it 2 years now? Time's a lie. Time's a flat circle. But it was just like Danielson's in the middle of this fantastic run, and then he just has this utter fart of a match with Jack Perry. But I thought he looked good here. I've always liked Luchasaurus. Now, Luchasaurus did have like the big botch of the match where he was badly out of position for a young buck dive. I've already forgotten which Jackson it was, but Jackson did like a moonsault off the apron, I think it was. Maybe it was off the ropes, but I think it was the apron. And Kill Switch was not there to catch him. And the Jackson ate a lot of shit. Did not look like it was fun. And Excalibur spent like 30 seconds trying to cover for it. And God bless him. It just did not work. And of course, instead of selling like the crash and burn, Young Buck got up and was like, all right, well, I guess we got to go to the next spot. And I wish that he hadn't done that, but I understand the way that they, in particular, these guys, how they lay out their matches, why that's not really all that viable. But still, it's kind of like, hey, maybe sell it for a second. Chris Statlander defended the title Women's World Championship against Mercedes Moné. Great match, I thought. I thought this was 4.5 stars. I thought this was another great one. They just killed each other out there. And I thought it was very impressive work. Moné has had a fantastic year as a performer. Chris Statlander has done great for herself in the ring. You know, not to repeat what I said earlier, but there are, I think there's got to be concerns with how she comes across as a, in talking style segments, but like, yeah, she's tremendous. So easy to say. Not a lot more to add here. Just thought it was worked really well. I thought the ending was very satisfying, kind of calling back to early moments of the feud. Great stuff. And then we had the main event with the steel cage. Adam Page losing the title to Samoa Joe. Positives and negatives here. Positives. Samoa Joe came off looking like the baddest man who's ever walked the planet. There were multiple shots of him just covered in blood in this match that, like, he looked like a barbarian god. And it's just so cool. But the match itself was low level, like low level notebook. I went, but if you just wanted to like say 3.5 to 3.75, that's fine. That's kind of where Samoa Joe checks in these days. It's been back to the Darby match as his one truly great singles match in AEW, and that's been several years now. On the plus side, he's not going to lay an egg. He will have very solid matches every time out. And I think more concerning is that, you know, I would not have continued the Hangman title reign. I think they actually ended it at a nice place. I didn't think they were going to, but I think they chose a nice place to end it at. But I think that the concerning part here, if that's the right term to use, is that Hangman is just kind of ended up in a title feud that just kind of happened. I can't really fault his performances. I thought he worked pretty hard, and I thought he had good promos at points. And I thought maybe sometimes the heel-face dynamic in some of the segments leading up to this match were a little weird. But other than that, I think that you know, that he did well. It just didn't work great. I guess I don't have a better way to put this, but like it felt like as soon as he won the title, and it was a huge moment when he won the title from Moxley, that the juice was gone by the following Wednesday, and it's really bizarre. I can't explain why it was like that, but they just didn't have a good follow-up form. I know there was, what, the MJF match, Fletcher, and then this Mojo series, and I assume they're going to continue a little bit with that, but, like, he's already off to the side now with return of the return of Swerve. Did not sleep well last night, so I'm trying not to pass out here, basically. I lack the terminology to put this into words right now, but he felt like a forgotten part of the show at times. And that's not a ability thing or a performance thing. It's a why is he being booked like this thing? And I never really understood it. Now, to break down the actual match, I thought it was worked well. Joe's matches are always going to be like 10 minutes shorter than other people's on this roster. That's just going to be part of the deal. I think it certainly seems like he's going to be a transition champ for Swerve coming out of the big angle afterwards. But let's talk about it. So Hook comes in with the title belt and he swivels the hips and does the big heel turn. Swerves everyone, pardon the pun. Which isn't really a pun. And, like, that's just kind of not big into that. It felt very, like, we're doing a turn just to do it. And that's not good. That's not good writing at all. It's if you don't have a reason for a turn to happen, you should come up with a reason before the turn happens. But I don't know. I mean, we're here now. I think in general, the ops doing this, being put as this, is a good idea in that I think they're a good heel unit. I think there are problems with it. I think that it's kind of odd to just a few months ago have the story of the company be somebody has to stop this evil heel group, and then go right back to basically a stable doing very much the same shtick. And I think that's a bummer in a way. They are slightly different from the Death Riders, but they aren't that different. And I think that's a problem. And I think that coming up with a way to better differentiate them from the Death Riders is essential to their success. So hopefully they'll be doing that some going forward. I just don't know about Hook, man. He has some presence, and he's not a bad worker at points, but I don't know that he's really, like, maybe he should be shifted over to, like, a Wheeler Yuta kind of pissant. Though that won't help the Death Riders ops comparisons. But that might suit him well as a heel. Now, I think that the Swerve return felt like a big deal. Swerve feels like a huge star, and this company needs its stars back. Because, like, Hangman's a star, but he's, not the biggest star. There's an argument, I guess, that Swerve's a bigger star. Now, he got, like, the return pop, so that's kind of hard to read. I think that, I think that this company, though, I mean, Ospreay's supposed to come back soon, and MJF feels like it could be any minute, and those are, like, the top two stars that are missing. And I think they need Kenny Omega to feel more like an actual member of the roster in some way. Like, it's not the fact, like, it, I went over this on our last episode with Tyler, it's not the number of matches he's worked, it's the kind of in-between where, like, it's not even he's around to cut promos or even doing, like, pre-tapes or anything. He just kind of disappears. And I feel like that's really hurting him long-term. And is there some kind of, like, I don't know if I want to keep doing this kind of thing with him? Like, again, this is the kind of Kenny Omega work that I am wary of buying into or anything, but at the same time, is he, like, you know, what are we doing? I don't know. So I thought this was a fun end to it. The post-match segment, I didn't like the hook turn that was a swerve, not swerve turn. I wish that was done a different way. I wish that was done in a more logical way to make it come off as a good, you know, there was justification for hook turning, because otherwise, like, you know, it's not good when you're like, oh, he was in on it and also had matches against us. Because, like, why would he do that? Why would anyone just be like, all right, so I'll, we're going to fight, but then I'm going to come out and we're going to do a bit where I, we're going to have several genuine matches with no sign that there's any kind of issue here. Like the four, you know, the world title number one contendership thing on the Friday Night Dynamite, the trios challenge with Kingston and Page, you know, even the match earlier on the show, none of this showed any kind of like hooks going to turn nonsense. And so it felt like it was not good booking there. So they can retroactively fix that, I think. Just come up with something good. Apparently, this is like the 2 minutes of the flagship I listened to. Apparently, they did or Powerhouse Hobbs tweeted, you know, he was in on it all along, which, no, please don't. That sucks. I don't know. Like, it's I'm not, like, worked up about it, but it's kind of like, you know, this is just... This is the kind of stuff they should be avoiding, and they don't avoid it, and the whole... You cannot be this similar to WWE at points and also be an alternative to them. You've got to differentiate, and that's kind of an issue AEW's been having for 12, 18 months, is that at points they get too similar to them. Definitely not by accident. And part of this is just how the industry is in its current state, because there's no, the path to be a fresh voice is very narrow. And it's very, I don't even know how you would break into the industry as a creative mind at this point without like having to be indoctrinated that the way WWE has done things for 20, 25 years is good, actually, and should be emulated elsewhere. And that is a massive problem, especially if you're a company trying to present yourself as something of an alternative. I'm not saying that if it's a thing if it's a thing WWE has done before in the past, AEW should never do it again. But I am saying that you need to have the tenor of your company feel completely different than WWE's. Part of that is working for AEW in the style of matches they have, particularly with the bloodier, you know, more brutal aspect of matches. Part of it is not working in that I think Renee Paquette is very talented, but I also think she is used a lot of the time, let me modify this. A lot of the time, I think she is used in a very uninspired way. And it's just like, we got to have her backstage and we'll do the, I guess at this time thing. And then maybe we'll have someone come in off screen and interrupt it like 3 seconds into the segment. Nothing has any time to breathe. I recognize that Mean Gene Okerlund is something that seems impossible to recreate now, but that's not good because he was great. I just was watching some clips of him guiding interviews and stuff, and it didn't matter if the guy he was with was a complete dud on the stick or if it was like Macho Man Randy Savage at his most insane in a positive way. He was contributing and helping steer those segments and keeping them on the rails, and I feel like that, you know, there's a lot of spontaneity in those segments. And I feel like AEW's backstage interviews are just so safe. Just very bland and safe and afraid of taking a chance. And I kind of missed the period of this company early on where they were willing to just do different shit. Just, when it comes to those kind of segments and just see what they can do. And, I remember the Cody Chris Jericho feud where Cody punches through a plate glass door to get at Chris Jericho, and that felt like an out of control situation. I remember John Moxley's debut in the company where he attacks Kenny Omega and puts him through a glass table. Lots of glass. And it felt like an out of control thing. AEW, despite the level of violence there is at times, and despite Saturday night having all these bloody matches and all of this, this level of violence that they've embraced as a company in their match styles and everything, I feel like it's all taking place in a safe as milk level promotion. And I don't need you to convince me that someone's going to pull a gun on someone backstage, but I need you to convince me that there is a level of chaos in this company, and I feel like that would help differentiate the company. And I think you need some kind of rawness, some kind of out of control chaos, basically. A little, repetitive there, I know, but the thing is that AEW feels like the show is on a track. And I'm not saying every segment needs to be like this or everything needs to be like this, but they need to have something happen semi-regularly that feels like it is unseen and out of control and like nothing else you'd see in wrestling TV, because WWE is always super safe, super stayed, super pat, whichever terminology you like, just very, very willing to do things one way and not change. And AEW needs to avoid that and they need to be unique. And I worry at times that they've forgotten this, or that they feel like being unique is a bad thing and that actually what they need to do is just be a carbon copy of WWE. But you can look through history, and long term, being a carbon copy of WWE is how TNA died, and it's helped kill WCW. And you can't do that. You got to be different. You got to march to your own beat of the drum, and I worry about AEW doing that. All right, that's the show. I thought it was, in general, a great show with some creative issues, mainly in the main event area. I do want to say that I was bitching about how this company felt very slow to have anything happen. I do feel like the ops turn slash win, and I feel like Swerve Strickland's return felt like big events in this company. They need to keep that going forward. They need to have a big angle on Wednesday this week. I would bet you money that they won't. I would bet you money that they would, that they'll just have Samoa Joe cut a promo, Swerve Strickland interrupt, Swerve Strickland kills eight security goons while Samoa Joe seethes on the top of the stage. And that feels so much more likely, but they need to do a segment where it feels very unique, and I hope they do. Anyways, that's it. That's the show. I hope you all enjoyed the pay-per-view, and I hope you all had a great time watching it Saturday, or if you're like me, mostly on Sunday. And I hope you all are doing well. I hope everyone has a great Thanksgiving. I definitely am hoping to get this up either by late Monday or Tuesday. Maybe, if you need a little entertainment on your way to or from grandma's house, or insert any other relative or whoever's house, or you're doing some driving, some flying, and I can help you enjoy yourself a little bit, that'd be great, you know? If you'd like to email us, feel free to. It's HungiePod, HungiePod at gmail.com. Again, that's HungiePod. We have a Red Circle thing you can give us money to. Certainly are under no obligation to do so. That's it. I'm done. This is, again, Fred. Appreciate y'all listening and making it this far. I hope y'all enjoyed. Talk to you soon. Take care. Happy holidays.
Hello, do you like New Japan Pro Wrestling? Are you a Shin Nihon freak? If so, check out the Super J-Cast with Joel and Damon on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network.
And even if you fucking hate New Japan Pro Wrestling, listen to the Super J-Cast anyway. Not just for our great show reviews, analysis, and pastrami sandwiches, but there's also usually some dick jokes somewhere in the obligatory opening 30 minutes of absolute nonsense we chat about every single week. That's the Super J-Cast for all the best talk about New Japan Pro Wrestling, crisps, and pornography.